Good afternoon, I'm Allison Bektesh. Coming up, Election 2018 and Beyond, a broadcast from the Aspen Security Forum at the Aspen Institute. Security experts agree that Russia is already interfering in this year's midterms. Though efforts are underway to stop them, what more can be done to put an end to Russia's interference in our elections and democratic institutions? This panel includes Monica Bickert, head of product policy and counterterrorism for Facebook, Tom Burt, corporate vice president for customer security and trust at Microsoft, Michael Chertoff, former secretary of Homeland Security, and Jeanette Manfra, assistant secretary of Homeland Security for cybersecurity and communications, along with Kim Wyman, secretary of state for Washington State. This panel is moderated by Michael Iskoff, chief investigative correspondent for Yahoo News. The talk will begin in just a moment. It is our summer pledge drive, and we couldn't do live broadcasts like this one from the Aspen Security Forum without support from you, our listeners. Lots of news outlets cover things like the Ideas Festival, the Security Forum, the Aspen Music Festival, and school performances, and so much more that comes through Aspen and the Roaring Fork Valley every year. But here on Aspen Public Radio, you can listen to sessions like this firsthand as they happen. We ask you to call in your pledge now so we can continue to bring you these type of live events as well as so much more. Go online, aspenpublicradio.org, to pledge your support. We go now to Defending Democratic Institutions, Election 2018 and Beyond.
We have a great panel to talk about the topic du jour, Russian interference in our elections and protecting our elections. To my left, Monica Bickert, former crackerjack federal prosecutor, now chief of product policy and counterterrorism for Facebook, the company right in the middle of this discussion. To her left, Michael Chertoff, former everything, including Secretary of Homeland Security and now head of the Chertoff Group. To his left, Jeanette Manfra, Assistant Secretary for Homeland Security for Cybersecurity and Communications, and actually is the point person for protecting our election this year. So there'll be a few questions for you, Jeanette. And Tom Burt, Corporate Vice President for Customer Security and Trust for Microsoft, and Kim Wyman, Secretary of State of Washington State. So, Assistant Secretary, I want to start off with you. No surprise. How does it feel to follow the boss, by the way?
I'm used to it. It's good. She's good.
Okay. You testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee last March, and in your testimony, you said Russian efforts to influence the 2016 U.S. presidential election demonstrated a significant escalation in directness, level of activity, and scope of effort compared to previous operations. So what went through your mind when you watched the president of the United States standing next to Vladimir Putin suggesting that which you had told the Senate had happened maybe had not have happened?
I would say that first, I think it was important for us to be able to continue to engage with Russia. Overall, we have to be able to engage with all countries. And I think the president has made it very clear since then that he does support the intelligence community assessment, which is what I was referring to in the testimony. So I'm comfortable with how things are going.
You're comfortable with how it turned out, but when you were watching it at the time, were you comfortable or uncomfortable?
I'll admit, I think I was sleeping while it was actually happening. But you know, when I watched the sort of the outbrief of the event and then talking about it, I think that the president's trying to balance a lot. And we have, as the secretary mentioned, we have a need to find ways to work with Russia. And I think he clarified his statements afterward and made it very clear that that he does support the intelligence community assessment. So, you know, I recognize I've been in government a long time. You have to balance a lot in these complex geopolitical relationships, and I believe that's what the president is trying to do.
A former colleague of mine, Ruth Marcus at the Washington Post, wrote a column the next day saying the only honorable course for people in positions such as yours was to resign. So I want to ask you the same question that Peter asked the secretary. Did you or have you considered resigning?
Never.
Michael Chertoff, if you were in the same position that you were in the past, Secretary of Homeland Security, and you heard the president say the kind of comments that he made in Helsinki, would you resign?
Well, first of all, I can't imagine President Bush saying that. But look, I would say this. It's really important to recognize that people like Assistant Secretary Manfra and Secretary Nielsen and others are doing important jobs, and they're actually doing things that are good and important. And I think as long as you feel you can do that, you should stay. If there comes a point in time that you no longer can function effectively, or you're asked to do or directed to do something that violates your conscience or the law, that's a different story. But you don't necessarily have to agree with everything as long as you can contribute and do the mission that you are assigned to do.
Assistant Secretary, there's been a lack of clarity about just what the nature of the threat right now is for the 2018 election. DNI Director Coates the other day said the system was blinking red, referring to Russian attacks on our digital infrastructure. FBI Director Wray yesterday said we hadn't yet seen intrusions into state election systems this time around like we did before. So help us clear up. I mean, is the system blinking red? Are there particular threats you're seeing playing out right now, or are you just speculating that the Russians will do the same thing they did last time?
Sure, and to sort of start with Director Coates' statement, which was much broader around our vulnerability of our digital infrastructure generally, I think from our perspective, what we see is actors attempting to get into critical infrastructure broadly. And then that's an attempt to hold us at risk in the homeland. And now whether they have the intent or what that escalation path looks like to use sort of disruptive capabilities that they may have in place is this longer discussion. But from my perspective, we do see a concerning increase in countries' nation-state attempts to infiltrate our critical infrastructure. We've issued a series of products specific to Russia attempting to intrude into our critical systems, energy systems, aviation, as others. I would, on the positive side, in that case, private sector and government worked very well together, and we were able to stop them from achieving any of their goals. But those sorts of things we see a lot. We also don't have perfect visibility into our critical infrastructure. Most of them are owned by the private sector. And what we see is intelligence. And so we need to work with the private sector to understand what they see so that we can correlate and better understand Russia or any nation state that's seeking to infiltrate our critical infrastructure. With regards to the election, I think you're right. I think it has been a little confusing because it's nuanced. And the way that we think about elections is you have a very broad foreign influence or malign influence problem that Director Wray and I think Dag Rosenstein will talk about as well. You have this broad sort of Russian efforts to really undermine our democracy, and this is not something new. This is a long-standing thing that they've been trying. Our digital platforms perhaps make it easier for them to scale and to do it more quickly. And so that's sort of a broad thing, elections being a part of that. And the FBI really has the lead on working to counter that. We support them. We distinguish between using digital platforms and others to spread false messages or all the things that are associated with malign influence. We distinguish between that and actual attempts to gain unauthorized access into a state or local system. And so while we see Russians continuing to attempt to influence and undermine our democracy, we're not seeing the targeting of the actual state and local election systems that we saw in 2016 right now. So that's how it's nuanced. I recognize it's complicated, but that's what we see.
But on that point, Tom Bird, I want to ask you, because Microsoft has been doing a quite innovative thing, trying to use the legal system to flush out Russian malicious actors, cyber actors. And we were talking just before this panel started, in the course of doing so, I want you to explain how you're doing that, but also you actually have found some evidence of Russian intrusion in this year's election.
So starting at the beginning of that story,
right,
which was part of the 2016 election, Microsoft's security team supported both the Republican and Democratic National Conventions. And during the Democratic National Convention, our teams observed that there were domain names being registered that looked like Microsoft domain names, but really weren't. And so our security teams and intrusion teams started to do some deep dive and discovered that these were being registered by an activity group that at Microsoft we call Strontium. One of the things all of you know is that there's no common naming for these activity groups. We use elements to track them, but it's the same group that's known as Fancy Bear or APT28, and that it's very much the subject of the newest indictment, where the indictment cites very convincing evidence that indeed that organization is directed by officials in the Russian GRU. And we don't know that. We know that their conduct is consistent with that, but the indictment cites a lot of evidence to support that. So that organization was registering fake Microsoft domains and using them for a variety of purposes, as command and control computers, as sites for phishing attacks to take and land those who were victims of phishing attacks. And by using fake Microsoft domains, it made the whole scam that they used to infiltrate and control their targets look more legitimate. So we actually treated that like we do with the botnets that were very active in taking down these criminal botnets. And we said, this is very similar. We can use a similar judicial remedy. So we went to court, Eastern District of Virginia, and we got an order taking all of those domains and transferring them to a Microsoft-controlled sinkhole. And we executed on that. And as a result, we actually saw evidence of the breadth of the infected victims that that organization that we called Strontium had.
How many domains did you find?
We ultimately have taken down 90 different domains in several different tranches. And so the goal here was to say to this organization, stop using Microsoft domain names. If you keep using them, we're going to make it more costly for you. We're not going to be able to stop them from doing their espionage activity, but we can say if you use our names, we can go to court and get a remedy that makes that whole thing more costly. And you're going to lose a bunch of the data that you were investing in the first place, because it's no longer going to come to you. It's going to come to us. And we've had several of those over the 2 years now that litigation's been ongoing. We've gotten a final judgment. We've put in place a very unique and innovative special master process so that now within 24 to 48 hours of us discovering that organization is registered or is using another fake Microsoft domain, we can get it taken down and transferred.
But in the course of doing this, you discovered some activity that's relevant to this discussion of 2018. So please tell us what that was.
That's right. So earlier this year, we did discover that a fake Microsoft domain had been established as the landing page for phishing attacks. And we saw metadata that suggested those phishing attacks were being directed at three candidates who are all standing for election in the midterm elections.
In this year's election, 2018, phishing attacks
against congressional the staff candidates. Of three candidates for election.
Can you tell us who they were?
We can't disclose that information because we maintain our customers' privacy, so we won't go there. But I can tell you that they were all people who, because of their positions, might have been interesting targets from an espionage standpoint as well as an election disruption standpoint. And we don't know the answer, but we took down that domain. And working with the government, actually we're able to avoid anybody being infected by that particular attack. Our teams...
So they did not get in to the
they did not get in.
Those candidates.
That's right. They did not get
but
in
they
to
tried.
Those candidates. They tried. They weren't successful. And the government security teams deserve a lot of the credit for that. But ultimately, that one was forestalled. I can say, consistent with what you've heard already, I think it's true because one of the things we've been doing, Microsoft's been doing over the last couple of years, is working in closer partnership with the other security teams in other leading technology companies, including Facebook, to share threat intelligence information, to look for opportunities where we can do joint operations, at least one of which was in the press last December, and what we can do to help protect our community using the threat intelligence information that we have. I would say that the consensus of the threat intelligence community right now is we're not seeing the same level of activity by the Russian activity groups leading into the mid-year elections that we could see when we look back at the 2016 elections. We don't see the activity of them trying to infiltrate think tanks and academia and in social networks to do the research that they do to build the phishing attacks that they then launch. And we're not seeing ongoing activity like the one we were able to disrupt much earlier this year. That doesn't mean, as Secretary said, it doesn't mean we're not going to see it. There's a lot of time left before the election. And so we and the others in the private sector are trying to be vigilant about that. And we're trying to do more than just that. Just a quick plug for one of the things we're doing at Microsoft is we've launched a Defending Democracy program. And we are working with secretaries of state. We are working with, we did 2 3-day seminars for both the Republicans and the Democrat community on how they can strengthen the security of the campaigns themselves, which are, you know, key attack vectors for the Russian actors. And so we did those 2 3-day seminars. We're going to continue to work both with campaigns and with the election process to see what we at Microsoft can do to bring to bear things that we can contribute to, you know, strengthening the electoral process in general. And that's across the election process, the campaign process, and even ultimately the whole much more challenging and interesting issue of how do we deal with disinformation in some way? And are there things the technology industry can do to contribute to that?
Secretary Wyman, you oversee elections in Microsoft's home state. Tell us what you are seeing so far in this election, and also put it in perspective from what you saw in 2016. Were they scanning, probing Washington State's election system?
Yes, they were.
They were.
They were.
And how did you learn that, and at what point?
Well, I know that for many people in the room, it seems like elections is new to cybersecurity, but those of you who know anything about our systems know that that is just patently not true. We've been in this field for 15 to 20 years. The moment we started putting internet results out on election night, we knew we could be vulnerable. So we've worked very diligently, you know, behind the scenes, like your world. We just kind of don't want you to think about us. If you don't know what election administrators do, then that means we're doing our job well if we're not the focus of the media. So in 2016, we started seeing activity on our servers that was unusual, and we were able to block a few IP addresses, and we had a suspicion that they might have been foreign actors, so we contacted the FBI and began working with them. And about the same time was when President Obama declared elections as critical infrastructure. And I can confess up here that as an election administrator, it made me nervous because the strength of our election system is that there are 7,000 people who are either elected or appointed who oversee elections at the local level and at the state level. And that's a strength because it's so decentralized, you can't have one person who could have an impact and change the outcome of the election. And it's a state responsibility. My nerve-wracking moment was kind of battling the resources that Homeland could provide to us and how it could just really strengthen our security against, I really don't want the federal government coming in and running our election system. And my role is to make sure that doesn't happen. So in 2016, we started working with Homeland Security, and it was a partnership that was a little bumpy at first because I think our worlds are, I think they're different, but I'm now realizing that they're very, very much the same. We're about transparency. My job is to instill confidence in the voters in my state and the voters across the country that our elections were fair and they were accurate and that people that were eligible had an opportunity to participate. And that's what the role and responsibility of every election administrator in this country. So we're about transparency. with the media, with the public. And all of a sudden, I remember distinctly when Assistant Secretary Monfra was being interviewed by Congress, and she was asked directly if the Russians had hacked our system, and she said that 21 states that were attempted, there was an attempt to get into 21 states, to which all of us went, wow, that's the first time I've heard that on the news. That's a little alarming, but okay. And our first question was, are we one of them? To which, of course, the answer was, well, we can't tell you.
All right, Assistant Secretary, can you explain?
But wait, there's more. So it was a little rough, and there were a few months where we couldn't know. And it was very frustrating from our end. But we understand now the why, and it makes a lot of sense.
What is the why?
The why is they were still working through the intelligence, and they were, you know, making sure that they weren't releasing classified information.
You already knew you'd been targeted.
We did, but we hadn't had it confirmed externally until, I mean, we were pretty certain we were one of the 21. Turned out we were. And I think what it led to, my bigger point here, is we worked through that communication challenge. And I was a little critical of DHS initially because I was frustrated. But out of that, we've worked really hard to get those communication channels worked through. We have a coordinating council now that is working very well to address those communication issues and work through it. Further, as we are working through this, you know, things, simple things like, and it's governmental territory, and for those of you in the private sector, I apologize, but our OCIOs that oversees the state system is part of our system, the backbone, but our system is separate. So when, for example, the MSISAC was giving us information, they would have meetings, and we'd find out about it 2 weeks later. And we would say, why weren't we in the meeting? Oh, well, you were. No, we weren't. Who was in the meeting? And then they would name our chief information officer for the state. And that's awesome, but that doesn't help me because my chief information officer needs to know that information directly. I don't report to the governor. I answer to the people. My responsibility is election administration. And that sounds really territorial, but it's an important distinction because if anything happens, it's not the governor who's going to be answering to the people. It's not the governor who's responsible. So we've worked through those, and I think that it's been a really good, healthy thing in the end because the resources that we're getting from Homeland Security are invaluable, and they're making our system stronger and are helping me be able to instill confidence in my voters that our system is strong and they can have confidence in it.
Assistant Secretary, you're obviously making a point of how closely you're trying to work with the states. And how many of them have taken you up on your offer of providing voluntary cybersecurity assistance based on the declaration of that the election systems were critical infrastructure?
Can I also address the 21 state thing?
By all means, yes.
Because there's been a lot of sort of different reporting on this. The entities that were targeted were notified at the time that we knew about it. There were certain things that we couldn't tell them at the time, partly because we didn't know. For those of you who deal in cybersecurity, you don't, and frankly for any sort of security, you don't know everything right away. You have to sort of continue to conduct an investigation. We knew that it was suspicious, and we wanted to make sure that they knew about it via the MSISAC. For those of you who aren't aware, the Multi-State Information Sharing Analysis Center, we partially grant fund this organization, and they have sensors that states can voluntarily participate in this program, but sensors deployed throughout the states. All states have at least some of their systems behind it. So we didn't have perfect visibility in 2016. We're working to improve that. So our process is whenever we get, there's two ways that we can get information that an entity or a person is being targeted. Usually we deal with nation state activity. One is through some reporting by a private sector entity or even a victim. And the other is through intelligence. And when we get that information, our priority is to engage with the actual victim or potential victim. We have a policy that we don't talk to anybody else about that potential compromise. We engage just with that victim. And we don't disclose who they are. where we ran into some issues that we didn't fully appreciate at the time is even though we notified the targets or the potential victims, we didn't at the same time have that sort of communications mechanisms with the secretaries of state. And so after engaging with that community for a while and talking about the kind of the 21 states as my state and what actually happened with my state, we recognized that it was important to go back and talk to all the actual heads of the election communities in those states to walk them through what actually happened. So we did notify. There's a lot of sort of reporting out there that we didn't notify until a year after it happened. That's not true. We did notify the actual targets. What we did a year later was actually engage with all the election senior administrators. And what Secretary Wyman is talking about is now we have in place a protocol, so it's very clear who DHS is going to notify in the event that there's anything happening within their state, and we don't run into this issue again, recognizing that we're not going to know everything at the time of the notification. So to your question, which I've now largely forgotten.
How many states have taken you up on cybersecurity assistance?
So we have there's a variety of different.
I should just say the reason I ask is because when then Secretary Johnson first proposed this in 2016, there was enormous pushback, especially from Republican secretaries of state who saw it as a federal takeover of state elections.
Okay. So all 50 states are partnering with us in some form or fashion. We have a lot of different sort of capabilities and offerings that we provide, but all 50 states are taking advantage of some capability that we offer, and they're all participating, importantly, in the Election Infrastructure Information Sharing Analysis Center, which the MSISAC runs. And that's the place where, similar to where industry has their own places where they can share information amongst themselves and have tailored products, that's the place where they can talk sort of amongst themselves, share best practices, but also communicate with us on any issues. So some specific things, we have the cyber hygiene scans, which is, we actually started with the federal government. We scan the entire federal government every single night, all external facing devices and sort of, hey, here's some critical vulnerabilities you got. You should look to patching them. It's a relatively common service, but we've got 34 states and 52 counties or localities participating in that. We have 5 election companies that are participating in that. Just because they're not participating with us doesn't mean they don't have the service. Most of them have it. We've also got 18 risk and vulnerability assessments, which is much more in-depth. Actually, us red teaming their systems, you know, trying to hack into their systems and giving them a report of sort of mitigation actions that they can take. But we have a variety of other programs that they're participating in.
You are listening to Defending Democratic Institutions, Election 2018 and Beyond, a broadcast from the Aspen Security Forum at the Aspen Institute. I'm Allison Bechtesh. Thanks so much for tuning into Aspen Public Radio on this afternoon. We know you value front row seats to things like the Aspen Security Forum, Spotlight Health, Aspen Ideas Festival. We have these partnerships in place, and we bring you this programming for free because we're supported by members like you. Go online, aspenpublicradio.org, to make your pledge. We are only able to bring you front row seats to the thinkers and leaders that come through the Valley because of generous support from our listeners. More than 60% of our budget comes from small donations from many, many listeners, and that makes up the strength in the programming that we have. Please go online, aspenpublicradio.org, and give what you can. Thank you.
I just want to ask you about one line in the indictment that the Justice Department released last Friday that popped out at me. You're talking about how you've been working with the states, but in the indictment, deep down, the indictment says that a guy named Kovalev, who's one of the GRU officers, and his co-conspirators, on or about October 28th, 2016, so very late in the election, visited the websites of certain counties in Georgia, Iowa, and Florida to identify vulnerabilities. That's the first time we heard about this, that they were actually getting into county websites that actually do the vote counting. First of all, were you aware of that? And secondly, how will you know or be alerted if the same sort of intrusions happen this time?
So it said they visited the websites,
right,
to look for vulnerabilities. That is not the same thing as actually gaining
intrusions,
unauthorized access into a system.
Right.
And that's frankly, we saw that a lot. The special counsel investigation is, it is a separate activity, and they are continuing to conduct investigations as they learn things relevant to our mission. We absolutely do work with them, it was, I guess I would just say, those weren't intrusions into the system. They were scanning, and if you talk to anybody who runs a system, they're scanned by malicious actors probably hundreds, if not thousands of times a week. And now that we're all talking about elections, I'm sure they've seen a massive uptick in that. So I'm not particularly surprised they're scanning. I think the good news story is they didn't get in. The defenses are working. That doesn't get enough play, but the state and locals have some pretty strong defenses. They're blocking these attempted intrusions, and I think that's important.
Kim, you had a quick.
Yeah, I just want to make one distinction that I think is really relevant here. In the elections world, you sort of have two systems. You have the election administration side, that is voter registration. That's all of your records that have your data, so we get you the right ballot on election day. The other side is the tabulation side, and that's the actual systems. Those are the systems at the county level and the local level that are actually tabulating the ballots that are counted. And those two systems are separate. And as I said, for the last 15 or 20 years, the best practice and the standard across the country is those tabulation systems are in no way, shape, or form ever connected to the internet. They are all physically secured and have a lot of physical security as well as electronic security. So when we're talking about the election system being hacked or people trying to get in, realize that the elections administrators across the country are very aware of the attempts that could be made, and they keep those systems air-gapped and away and not Wi-Fi connected and all of those things as a security measure. So
but
we're talking about separate.
Following up on that, I want to read you a story that has just broken the last few days, a disclosure that came about because of a series of letters that Senator Ron Wyden wrote to Election Systems and Software, which is the nation's top voting machine maker, and they admitted in correspondence with Senator Wyden that the company had installed remote access software on election management systems it sold over a period of 6 years. So that suggests there is a vulnerability there. Is there not, Assistant Secretary, if some of our voting systems have remote access?
Absolutely. If they were configured in a way, or the secretary set them up in a way to actually allow that to be connected to the internet, which they don't. I think remote access on very, critical systems is probably not a good idea, whether you're running an energy system or a voting machine. But there are compensating controls, and I guess I would defer to Secretary Wyman, that they put in place to ensure that regardless of what vulnerabilities a machine has, there's other physical controls they have in place.
Correct. Monica Bickert, I have a lot of Facebook questions.
Right.
But before I start, I have one more question on the indictment for Michael Chertoff about something that struck me. The indictment announced by Deputy Attorney General named 12 Russian GRU officers and, quote, others known and unknown to the grand jury. The U.S. intelligence assessment from January 17 that everybody has now endorsed and said they agree with said all this activity was ordered by Russian President Vladimir Putin. Based on what you know about the way indictments are drafted, you were the former head of the criminal division, is Vladimir Putin an unindicted co-conspirator in that indictment?
I mean, that would be a really wild guess, to use a technical term. I mean, it is very
standard. And why wouldn't he be?
Well, it's very standard to have a line in an indictment that talks about others known and unknown. Partly that's because there may be others who are would be unindicted co-conspirators. Partly it leaves the door open to adding people as more evidence comes in. So, look, I mean, the intelligence community has made an assessment. I don't think it's surprising that an operation like this would be authorized at the highest levels. And, in fact, I should mention that the Homeland Security Group issued a statement, which I think is on the Aspen website, making it very clear that the members of that group believe that there's this was something that was definitely authorized by the Russian government. But to guess as to what that line means is
but to include a foreign leader as in either unindicted co-conspirator or an indicted co-conspirator, which the Justice Department has done from time to time.
Right.
I think of Manuel Noriega.
Exactly.
Why wouldn't Putin be named in this indictment?
I mean, the answer is if there's enough admissible evidence to indict somebody, you would name them, provided you think, A, that there's no collateral or different reason to keep them out, either to keep evidence, you know, confidential for a while or because it's pointless, because you're never going to get the person. So, I mean, you'll have to ask the people who wrote the indictment about this. This is would be a wild-ass guess on my part.
Okay.
It's a technical term.
Facebook has been sort of in the middle of this whole discussion on multiple fronts. Monica, I want to ask you just sort of basic threshold question here. During the 2016 campaign, the U.S. government was very focused on the cyber intrusions. Mm-hmm. And largely missed the huge social media component, thousands of Russian trolls from the Internet Research Agency creating phony accounts, placing phony ads on Facebook, paid for with rubles. How is it that Facebook also wasn't aware that this activity was going on?
I'll echo some of what's been said up here, which is that there was definitely more of a focus on the traditional types of cyber intrusion and hacking and phishing attacks on the Facebook infrastructure that we were focused on. And in 2015, we're seeing activity by APT28 and reporting that to the relevant authorities. The information operations, that is a much tougher thing to define and detect. And it violated our policies because we require people to be authentic on Facebook, and these were accounts that were behaving inauthentically. But detecting these accounts was something that we were far too slow to do. Some of the things that we're doing.
Weren't the ruble payoffs kind of a clue from the get-go?
Well, you know, the reality is we've got 6 million advertisers, and advertisers pay in a variety of different currencies. Some of these were in rubles. We have legitimate Russian advertisers. And as has been widely reported, the content in these ads, much of it would not on its face have violated our policies. This was content that was a little harder to find if you were looking at the face of the content. Like there's some sorts of policy violations where you look at the face of the content and it obviously violates the policies, you remove it. That's the easier stuff. The harder stuff is looking at who the speaker is and determining if that is really the right person. And that's actually quite hard to do. What we're doing now to try to get better, and we are in a much better place, a couple things. One is introduce some real barriers and some deterrence into the process. And some of that involves requiring a greater transparency around political or issue ads than is required even with television advertisements. So now, if you want to run a political or issue ad on Facebook, you have to go through an identity verification. You've got to be within the United States. We mail you something. You show us a government ID and last four of your social security number. I mean, it's a pretty onerous process. So this is designed to ensure that the people who are advertising about political issues in the United States are American actors, and we know who they are. And now we're also showing on those ads who has paid for that ad. You can also click and go to an ads library. By the way, if this sounds like a big change, it is. And if it sounds easy, it's not. We've had all kinds of enforcement errors. Because trying to detect what is an issue ad, trying to define that, has proven to be incredibly thorny. And we've had...
How do you define it?
We are looking at the proposed language in the Honest Ads Act as a guide. We're also talking to a lot of third parties. So if something is a legislative issue of national importance, or if it concerns an election or a candidate for election, that's something that we would include. And you can go on our site and you can see exactly how we define this, but you get into these really thorny questions about whether or not something should be covered or not. And right now, we're taking a broad approach of saying, even if this seems really overbroad, we want to make sure we're erring on the side of knowing who these advertisers are. Another reason that this is notable is because when advertisers are running ads on social media, they expect it to be fast. That's the whole beauty of it. You want to have a sale tomorrow, you go on today, and you promote, you know, whatever you're doing, and it goes live right away. That can't happen now. And we've had a lot of advertisers say to us, this is too onerous for us to have to get something in the mail and respond and get authorized. That's the sort of precaution we're putting in place now as a barrier.
Purchased advertising component,
right.
But you also are dealing with the fake news, hate speech, and other areas where you're trying to police content. And I know you've set up a whole new systems for doing that with artificial intelligence, then reviewed by actual people.
Yes.
Who have,
but generally.
Yeah, when people look at Facebook, you know, they look at things like InfoWars, Alex Jones, who has published all sorts of stuff, Sandy Hook massacre didn't take place, Pizzagate, yet they're still up on Facebook. Why is InfoWars still up on Facebook?
So anytime the InfoWars posts content that violates the policies, we remove it, which we have done. But there's a difference between removing the violating content and actually removing the speaker. There is a point at which we will do that if people continue to violate our policies. InfoWars is not there yet. But if they meet that certain threshold, then we will remove them. In terms of how we think about false news, because I know there's a lot of questions about it, there's a couple things we do. The majority of the false news content that you see on a social media site like Facebook is the financially motivated spam type of stuff. So you defeat that by, in our case, largely using technology and artificial intelligence to identify accounts that are spreading spam, accounts that are false. We've gotten a lot better at that in the past couple years, and now, before the German election, before the French election, we were removing tens of thousands of accounts. Before the Alabama special election, we were removing a lot of accounts using that sort of technology that were Macedonian spam type accounts. So that's one thing you do. But then you have these stories that are misinformation. You know, people on different sides might say this is just sensational or this is clearly false. What we're doing there is we don't remove the content. What we're doing is trying to provide more information so that people can put the content in context. So if there is a story that might be false, and that might be because people have reported it to us as false, or because our technology is telling us that, for instance, in the comments under, you know, you share that story and your friends all say, this is a hoax, you idiot, or that sort of thing. If our technology is picking up on that, then we send that to third-party fact checkers. If they agree that this story is false, then what we do is we counter the virality of it, so we'll reduce the distribution. And then we include, for anybody who sees that on Facebook, related articles. So you see the article, and then underneath it, it's a series of, here are the other articles from mainstream publications around the internet, so that you have the ability to put that in context. That's a result of having tried a couple different things and looked at what tends to engage people. Like, initially what we were doing was saying, this story is disputed, click here to learn more, and we were finding that that didn't necessarily drive people to click and learn more. The related articles and providing more information is working better.
But I have to say that there is still confusion about your thresholds for when you take stuff down and when you don't, and there is seemingly, inevitably, a lot of arbitrariness to it. Now, Motherboard just published some of your internal guidelines for
We published those.
Oh, you published them. Okay.
we published those back in late April.
Training document for hate speech says that a organization or public figure, if there's a page that has the page has to receive 5 strikes within 90 days for the page itself to be deleted. Facebook moderators are told to remove a page if at least 30% of the content posted by other people within 90 days violates Facebook's community standards. And in another hate speech document says a profile should be taken down if there are 5 or more pieces of content from the user which indicate hate propaganda, photos of the user present with another hate propaganda. So that seems like, first, a bit complicated.
It's far more complicated than that, even.
But who's making the call on whether this is a strike that goes against you or whether this is, an example of hate speech?
This is one of the interesting parts of our job is trying to figure out what the consequences should be for any one policy violation. So the policies are public. They have been for years. Back in April, we took a really unprecedented step in publishing the internal guidance that we give our reviewers. Every once in a while, these things would get published. They'd get leaked. They'd get published in the news. And our thought was sort of, we might as well just put it out there. If people want to know it, let's just put it out there. So we published it in April. And now you can go on the site, and you can see the guidance that we give our reviewers. Now, when it comes to enforcement consequences for policy violations, there's obviously a lot of different shapes that violations could take. If you upload an image of child sexual abuse imagery, your account comes down immediately. It's reported to law enforcement. If you bully somebody in your high school class, you get a warning. So there's different sorts of levels of consequences for different types of policy violations. We also have different levels of reviewers, and reviewers are trained in different ways. So some reviewers are dealing with certain types of content where the answers might be more simple, and in certain instinct, for instance, we had a report recently that said something like, when reviewers see this content, they are never to delete it, and they are never to leave it up on the site. They are to mark it as sensitive and escalate it. And what that means is, sometimes the reviewers have to send it up to a higher level. And so what the enforcement consequences are, there is a rubric for that, but it's pretty complicated. With pages, you might have a page that has 20 administrators and it's publishing 300 pieces of content a day. And you've got one bad actor among the administrators. And what we would rather do is take action against that one person or let other people in that page have the opportunity to reform the page.
Do your reviewers actually have debates among themselves? Does this qualify as hate speech or misinformation or not? And as a corollary, are you the ultimate arbiter? Are you the content cop?
There's about 7,500 reviewers. Actually, there's more than that now, but that's the last public number that we've used, sitting around the world who do the first level of review. They have really no leeway to have conversations about should we count this or not. The rules, if you go look on our site, the rules are very detailed and objective. Now, that's great in one way because it's good at things like reducing bias and getting things escalated. It's bad in another way, in which by that I mean you sometimes have content that's really close to the line, and yet our rules, when applied, will say, in this case, we don't consider this bullying. And everybody in this room would look at it and say, oh, it's clearly bullying. But our rules don't cover it because we've written the policy to cover the majority of cases. So anyway, the rules are fairly detailed and objective. If a reviewer thinks that the prescribed policy outcome doesn't make sense, then they can escalate it up the chain. It would come to my team. And yes, we will sometimes, we'll look at it, we'll say, well, we're going to make a call that we think is consistent with the additional context we have. Senior leadership will be involved in those conversations sometimes. We also have a policy that says if something is in the public interest but otherwise violates our policies, we may leave it up. The most common scenario for that is if something is nudity. We typically wouldn't allow, for instance, an image of a prepubescent child with genitals showing. But let's say that this is a photo after an atrocity and there's a victim of a bombing and this is being shared to spread awareness and there's child nudity visible, but it's very clear that this is for newsworthy purposes. In that case, we might override the policy.
Larger question here, which is that given that so much of the world now communicates through Facebook and Google and Twitter. Michael Chertoff, should we be comfortable that we're letting them decide, Monica and her cohorts and the other social media companies, decide what we can read and what we can't?
Well, I would say this. I'd say, first of all, it's better than having the government decide, because the government's going to have an interest in a certain way. But I do think it's challenging, and one of the things I would say in general, and I understand, you know, what Monica's trying to wrestle with here, is on the one hand, there is some editorial responsibility. You can't incite violence. You can't deliberately and systematically propagate things that are hateful. But we still basically have a default position in the US in favor of free speech as far as content is concerned. And I think it's completely appropriate to disclose who's saying things and to point out where there are things that have countervailing issues. That's part of the marketplace of ideas. But it's really easy to go down the slippery slope of beginning to say, well, this is fake, and pretty soon it's someone's going to decide what they like and what they don't like. And I will tell you, if you want to go to a place where, if you want to read their literature, they will absolutely tell you that it's appropriate for the government to control content. It's in Russia, where they define cyber warfare as to include information that they don't like. So I think it's not a great situation, and ideally people would self-educate, and we have to do that, but I think that the approach they're taking is a pretty balanced approach.
Monica, you had something you wanted to add.
Yes, I would really agree with that. I would note that speaking to an American audience about this is different than when I speak elsewhere. More than 85% of the people using Facebook are outside the United States. And when I'm having conversations in the rest of the world, sometimes the instinct is, well, if it's illegal under our government's laws, or if our government says that it shouldn't be up there, take it down. And so we do have a process in place in specific countries where a country gives us legal processes and says something is illegal, that we may block it in that country only. It is often not the outcome that you would want. Yeah. What we try to do in crafting our policies is make sure that we're not doing it in a silo. So every other Tuesday, we have a meeting. It's a global meeting, lots of people from different teams across the company, operations, engineering, legal, and so forth. But we're also engaged with more than 100 groups and experts outside the company to get their feedback on specific policy issues. So for instance, next Tuesday's meeting, maybe we're considering what we're doing with photos of fetuses. This is a real issue. I mean, we deal with all sorts of sort of odd issues like this. What we would do is reach out to groups and experts on free speech, on pro-life, pro-choice, and make sure that we're understanding how people see this issue and how we can best craft the policy for a global population that's using our service.
And you also just published new guidelines on misinformation, I believe. Tell us about that and how that works. And that sounds like a variant of fake news, but I gather it's something more specific.
Yes, this is our recent announcement was about something we're trying to get ahead of, and I'll be candid in that this is something that we're still trying to figure out. In general, if we have people that are sharing news that may be false, the approach is what I described earlier. The fact checkers, and then if something appears to be false, reducing the distribution, sharing information, not removing it. We are, however, thinking that we will see situations where there is violence on the ground that is closely linked to speech such as a doctored video or photo, the things that are sometimes referred to as deep fakes. So you've got a situation, let's say that there's some tension in a region and you've got ongoing riots, and somebody puts a photo up and says, look what the police just did in this region, or something that is intended to stoke violence. And we're putting in place a framework for having trusted partners in areas that we could reach out and confirm, is this linked to ongoing or imminent threat of real-world violence, and is this content false? And if so, we'll actually remove the content.
Yeah, really important, because there's one of the concerns I think people have is an operational impact where somebody does, in fact, say, for example, oh, there's a storm here, run there, and actually it's the reverse. And I do think we've seen examples of this, so that's a very important capability.
I want to get to questions, but before I do, I have one last question for you, Assistant Secretary. I went over your testimony last night, and in it, You referred to the NPPD, the National Protection and Programs Directorate.
Rolls off the tongue.
The NCCIC, the National Cybersecurity and Communications Integration Center, the EIS, the Election Infrastructure Subsector, the EAC, the Election Assistance Commission, the GCC, the Government Coordinating Council, the EIS SSP, the Sector Specific Plan, the ETF, the Election Task Force, and my favorite, MS-ISAC, the Multi-State Information Sharing and Analysis Center. On behalf of everybody here at the ASF, I'd like to ask you, is there an assistant secretary for acronyms?
I wish that was my job.
That's usually in the Department of Defense, actually.
Yes. We have our own language. If I could say one thing, National Protection and Programs Directorate, that is the name of our agency within DHS that does cybersecurity and critical infrastructure protection. We continue to try to work with Congress to change our name because we need an act of Congress to change our name.
What do you want to change it to?
Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. And
The acronym for that?
CISA, of course. Okay. So actually, under Secretary Spaulding, started this in the last administration, and we're continuing it. We do have a bill passed in the House and one out of committee in the Senate, so we're really hopeful that we can get that changed. But it is really important the jokes on the acronyms completely get that. I think you all had to have a special lesson on all of our acronyms.
Yeah.
But to have an agency name that reflects what we do, it's hard to go around telling people that we work for NPPD. So if I could just put a plug in for that.
Questions? Gentlemen, all the way back there.
Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us. Elmar Tevison, security analyst for ZDF German TV. This is a question for Monica. Given the rise of anti-Semitism around the world, specifically in Europe and also in parts of the US, can there be such a thing as unintentional Holocaust denial? I'm, of course, asking that question because of the remark that Mark Zuckerberg made. And how much of a role does intention play in the application of the guidelines, also the most recent guidelines you just referred to?
Great question. So generally, our approach is if people celebrate the Holocaust, if they try to justify the Holocaust, if they defend it in any way, we would remove that. We would remove any content that mocks survivors or victims of the Holocaust as well. And we also would remove Holocaust denial content in countries where governments have asked us to do so because it's illegal. So for instance, in a country like Germany, we would remove it. Now, in a country like the United States, where in fact it's constitutionally protected speech, we will apply those other policies. If people are celebrating it or defending it, we would remove it. But we do not generally remove content just because it is factually inaccurate. And that's true whether people are talking about any world event or any other situation. We don't have a policy on Facebook that requires you to be truthful.
What about people who have postings denying the Armenian genocide?
The same policy would apply. So there's no requirement to have your facts right. However, if people are celebrating violence, encouraging violence, justifying violence, or mocking victims of violence, any of that content would be removed. I should also say that sometimes we'll see content that is coming from, again, this distinction between content and bad actors. Often the content that you'll see is being shared by people who are hiding behind fake names. And we do have a policy on Facebook that requires you to use your real identity. So oftentimes accounts or networks of accounts that are using inauthentic means will also be removed.
Well, I want to thank our panelists. I just want to say, and I also would invite the audience to take everything they've said here today and then apply the International Code Checking.
The International Fact-Checking Network Code of Principles.
Yes, okay.
You've been listening to Defending Democratic Institutions, Election 2018 and Beyond, a broadcast from the Aspen Security Forum at the Aspen Institute. I'm Allison Bechtesh. Thanks so much for tuning in during our summer pledge drive here at Aspen Public Radio. Live broadcasts like this one from the Aspen Security Forum are the cream of the crop of some of the offerings we give you throughout the summer. Think about what it takes to bring this broadcast to you. We have a producer on site and all the equipment that brings it over the airwaves onto the board at this end. Someone reporting the news that comes out of these talks. You have a full news team and a front row seat to some of the biggest events in Aspen because of members like you who support Aspen Public Radio. If you've enjoyed this broadcast and have yet to give, think about where you're spending your money and what you value. Public radio is an asset to the community, and it happens because the public decides it's worth spending a little bit of money on. We're looking to you now, aspenpublicradio.org, and thanks. This is Aspen Public Radio, broadcasting on KAJX Aspen and KCJX Carbondale. This broadcast and all the other broadcasts from the Aspen Security Forum can be found online, aspenpublicradio.org.